accession number 28642, Reel 10.
Well, I was going to ask, you know, you were speaking about your experiences of dropping debt charges, but your experience, you're on the other, on the receiving end.
No, I've never been debt charged. Some people are disappointed that I haven't had this exciting experience. I wasn't at all disappointed. Some Marines' only strong point is not being detected. If you are detected, then your chances of survival are not as good. Well, I don't believe I was ever detected. I was certainly never discharged. In fact, my submarine was X-24, only experienced one discharge, and that was when we were approaching the Shetlands on outward bound for Bergen. There was a Norwegian destroyer helping to escort us, and she dropped a discharge for practice and didn't tell anybody. That sounded very loud, but it was far away not to do any damage.
Let's talk then about your experience in relation to, as I understand, being involved with dropping spies, intelligence officers ashore prior to the 44 landings in June.
Yes, I was involved in trials for that. They all carried out on the island of Bute when naval officers who were trained in swimming and going ashore and carrying out reconnaissance came aboard, and we did a lot of these trials in Ettrick Bay, which is on the south side of the island of Bute. Several submarines did the trials, but when it came to actually going across to Normandy and doing it, I wasn't chosen to do that. I was doing the Bergen run at that time. But Ken Hudspeth, a Tasmanian, who was a very effective commanding officer, he did it in his submarine, which was X-20, and he went, having done the trials in the Clyde, he then went across to Normandy, and he went across twice. First of all, it was on reconnaissance, when he put swimmers over the side at night, and they swam ashore, took soundings, and took notes of the obstacles and so on. They came back. They were going to go again, but Admiralty decided that it was a risk. They got away with it once without being seen, and of course the landing beaches were very secret, and they reckoned that they had enough information, so he wouldn't go again until before D-Day, which he did in company with another submarine, and they took up station at the north and the south end of the British landing beaches, and each night they would surface, listen to the BBC, and there'd be a coded message in the BBC program telling them whether the invasion was on that day. Well, for a day or two, the message was no, it wasn't. And then on the eve of D-Day, they got the message that it was. So before dawn that day, 6th of June, we all know, 1944, they came to the surface, anchored the submarine in the exact position, and set up homing signals, flags and lights, and I think a sonar signal as well. So the enormous invasion fleet came in between these two submarines and they landed on exactly the same, the right beach. It must have been a great risk, I would think, because they were within German gunnery range, and if the Germans had seen them and identified them, then they'd be sitting targets. But it didn't happen to them. So that was a great feat of navigation on Huntsman's part, not to be seen and to be in the right place.
What were your duties to be following Bergen?
When I got back from Bergen, the submarines being built for Far Eastern service were being built, and I was appointed as commander to standby XE4. So at the right time, my crew went down to Barrow and Furness, to Vickers Armstrong's, where these XE craft were being built, and we stood by for 2 weeks while they were being finished, and then accompanied them on their railway journey back to Scotland. So we were aboard when they were launched, and then we started first of class trials. So when you launch a new designer submarine, you put it through all its paces to ensure that it can do what it's supposed to do and so on. So we did that, which is very interesting.
So you're talking about the trials?
Yes, well, the most exciting part of all this is the delivery from the shipyard to Scotland, which is by train. We had our own special train, a locomotive and a spacer carriage, then a bogey carriage with which took the submarine, and then a spacer at the other end because the submarine overhung both ends, and then a passenger coach, which is ours, and the guards van. And usually the shipyard packed the hamper for us with the trip north. And that was very good, because as it was our own train, we could impose upon the engine driver to let us ride in the cab. And we were horrified to find out they didn't keep a lookout. I suppose they knew where to look for signals, but we didn't go anywhere without looking all the time. But when we arrived in Scotland, in the Gaelic, there was a floating crane there which picked the submarine up off the carriage and put it in the water. And that was an exciting time too, for the first time the submarine is floating, and you go down below and make sure that there's no water coming in, and then cruise on the motor away from the floating dock and then start the engine and get down the Clyde to the island of Bute. That's very good. But the trials are many and varied. We do speed trials to make sure the speed you make under certain engine revolutions and motor revolutions. Do turning circles with the various degrees of rudder at different speeds to find out what your turning radius is, which is used for dead reckoning navigation. We do a deep dive. They're designed for 300 feet, and we go to one place in the Clyde, which is 300 feet deep, and meet up there with a boom defence vessel. These vessels that are made for raising wrecks and lowering moorings and nets, they've got horns over the bow, and they can engage in heavy lifting. But we would come under the bow, shackle on a heavy cable, and they lower us down to 300 feet, just in case things went wrong, and we had lost buoyancy and had to be hauled up again. Well, that was always a little bit worrying, but it went fairly well. When you get down to 300 feet, the ocean is dark outside, you can't see anything, and you check around for leaks. They were always successful, we never had any bothers, and came up, we were always glad to get to the surface again, and unshackle this heavy cable. One of the worries is that if you did have a leak, you can't blow main ballast and come up, because you come up underneath the boom vessel. You've got to call up the telephone and say, we are leaking, would you please haul us up? And then they clank away with their winch and you come up very slowly. But it always went well. And then nearby, this deep hole in the Clyde, is the Holy Lock, where Admiralty had a sound range. They had hydrophones slung on buoys down the lock, and there we'd race up and down on engine and on motor while the boffins ashore would record all our sounds. Then we would moor up between a couple of buoys and dive the submarine, stopped, and in telephone communication run each of the pumps and motors and other devices to see how much noise they made. Then after all that we'd come ashore and they'd give us our signatures and tell us which items to not to run and which to run. And we found the greatest noise was made with the high pressure air system when we're blowing tanks. Sometimes the manifolds at the junction boxes where the air comes in and is distributed to the various tanks are brass castings that are drilled. And sometimes if the drilling is not accurate, they form some knife edges or something like an organ pipe inside, and they make tremendous whistles. So sometimes we've had to go back and have them taken out and welded up to stop these organ pipe effects. But it was reassuring to know just how safe these were from the sound detection point of view. We had to go over the anti-magnetic loops and make sure we were not creating a magnetic signature and so on. That's not so tedious. I rather enjoyed those trials because We only did it by day, and we'd come back to a good dinner and shower and bed at night. Except when we went to the Holy Loch, we stayed in digs there because we were away from our depot ship. But that was nice too. One hazard there was that the Holy Loch community had sort of adopted the submarine service, because every submarine went up there. And this is Loch Goyle, because Loch Goyle Hotel, Loch Goyle Head Hotel, also adopted submariners. And after a day's hard work, making noises, we'd go and have a drink on the way home. And the local community would insist on buying us a whiskey. And that was a terrible hazard to get back to the digs in good order. But we liked it there. In fact, one of the digs we had, I forget the lady's name now, but she got to know us quite well. And when Mary and I were married, she sent us a wedding present, which is very nice. Mary could probably remember her name, but I can't.
In relation to your experience, obviously you mentioned that you were in Bergen at the D-Day landings. What were you hearing of the progress of the war, given your situation in Scotland?
Well, we were actually... I'd come back from Bergen, and I was married on the 14th of June. D-Day was the 6th of June. So we didn't know when D-Day was to be. All I knew was that in anticipation of our wedding, I'd applied for leave and for permission to travel, because in advance of D-Day, all leave was stopped and all travel was stopped. But the captain of the flotilla was very decent to me. He knew Mary too. And my first lieutenant was at sea. He'd left our flotilla, was at sea training in a big submarine. And he was my best man. So everything was set up for us. We were given leave. Well, we still didn't know when D-Day was. Joe Brooks' submarine was recalled from exercises, and he was put ashore and came up to be our best man. And we managed to get accommodation in a hotel on the Thames, because accommodation was a bit scarce too. But because D-Day happened on the 6th, and we knew that all right. Because it was sort of, it was news then. We didn't know it was going to happen, but once it happened, the news covering was pretty good. And we found out afterwards that Ken Hudspeth and George Honor, the other submarine commanding officer, had done their job in guiding the fleet in, and they'd arrived at the right place at the right time. So it was all good. And when Mary and I went off in the train to London, and then up the River Thames to a place called Marlow, it was a hotel called the Complete Angler, on the banks of the Thames, ideal place for honeymoon or any other holiday. It was fine weather, and we'd walk along up the Thames and lie on the grass in the sun and watch the gliders being towed over to France, and I felt a bit guilty. You know, I was having my honeymoon while those poor old soldiers were going over there to face the enemy. But it didn't seem to want me, so...
What was the news you were hearing, though, of progress?
Well, we knew that the weather was against it, and there was great difficulty in landing all the supplies. But we knew that the air defence of France by the Germans was almost non-existent, and the Royal Air Force were doing very well. And the weather calmed down after a few days. For a while it was touch and go, but because I've learned most about this by reading about it since. At the time, we only heard by the BBC broadcast, and of course, there it's subject to the propaganda censors, and we know now that all the British news was slanted in favour of the British morale, and the German was slanted their way. I felt reasonably confident that it would go all right.
What was the feeling like in London at the time?
In London, we arrived in London when the first of the buzz bombs arrived. And I'd said to my bride, being a man of the world, well, don't worry if the air raid sirens go. They always go, but it's usually a false alarm. The air raid sirens went and it wasn't a false alarm. It was followed by a very big bang. And this is one of these buzz bombs landing in London. And... because it was in the news next day as to what it was. We read the papers and found out about that. But we're only one night in London. Then we went up river to Marlow, and even there the sirens went, and we heard a crash. And when I was trying to get accommodation, I had difficulty. I went into a few pubs and got negative replies from all of them. But one of the rent officers in Barbell, our shore base, had said her father was a mine host at a pub at the Bells of Easley, which is just down the river a bit from Marlow. And if we couldn't get anywhere else, he could get us in there. He wasn't mine host, he was supplying them with grog. He was a wine and spirit dealer. But luckily we got reply from the complete angler at Marlow that they could give us accommodation for, I think, 6 days or something. So we didn't have to go to the Bells of Easley, which was just a whirl, because on the first night at Marlow, a bomb hit the Bells of Easley pub, and it wiped out the accommodation. So that was about as lucky an escape as I've had. But, everybody we met was on holiday, and the morale was always good through the war, pretty good. I was never in London during the Blitz, but it would be a bit iffy, I would think. But the morale was always good wherever I was, and so was ours, because we were all subject to propaganda. We know now it was a bit slanted our way, but it was fairly good.
What was your experience of the American forces, if any?
Well, we didn't have any much to do with them while we were in Britain. The only close contact I had was when we were on one of these trial excursions. We were in the Gower, and we had to be demagnetised, and that took 2 days. So we did one day's work, and at night we were supposed to go ashore to a naval barracks, which was pretty Spartan. But there was a tank landing ship moored near us, flying the American flag. So we went alongside that, and said, went aboard and introduced ourselves, and said, is there any chance you'd have a spare bunk for the night? And they said, yeah, sure, we'll have a spare bunk. Come and have chow with us. So we ended a very big meal, and they could see the submarine lying alongside, and they asked us a lot of questions about it. And they said, it must be pretty Spartan living in those things. And we said, oh, yes, it is, but it's okay. And they said, look, we're handing over to the Royal Navy in a couple of days, and there are certain stores that the Navy don't want. If they're any use to us, to you, you might as well have them. They're down in the hangar down below where they carry the vehicles at the landing. So we went down there, and there was a heap of food. It was absolutely wonderful. All the food that was rationed in Britain, like there was tins of sugar, tins of fruit, tins of butter, all kinds of things. So we said, yeah, we'll have all of that. So we put the hatch covers off, and we had four of the crew. So we had one down on the hold loading up, one on deck pulling it up, one on the side lowering it down, one on the submarine stowing it. And we took the whole lot. It must have been about a ton of stores. And there's not too much space in the submarine to store it. So we filled the control room up. So when you went down the hatch, you had to crawl over this great heap of food. And we thought, well, next day we had to do degassing trials. If we've got to dive, we'll never come up again. All the stuff. Anyway, we didn't dive, so that was fine. When we got back to the flotilla, we had several crew that weren't with us. We had 10 men attached to the submarine, so we had a share out of spoils. We gave the captain of the ship a couple of tins of butter, which he could send to his wife down in Wales. So that was very good. In fact, as I was married by then, we were given some blankets to sleep in during the night. The next day, when we went to take them back, because they came out of the store with their wrappers on them. And they said, oh, we don't want those back, you can have those. So I took all the blankets, and we still got them. I built them on my yacht. So I was more interested in that than butter, but I got my share of butter as well. So that was one contact with the Americans, and that was very good, of course. But the next contact we had was when we got out in the Pacific, and when we were given the job of cable cutting, Admiral Fife, who was in charge of submarines in the Pacific, he came aboard our ship, Bonaventure, with all of his staff, and there were lots of them. And they lived aboard, and they were very impressed with our dining. It was very good. what they liked most was the horseradish sauce and things like that. The ordinary food to the board then, they liked hashed up food. But they were okay. Of course, aboard Bonaventure, which was we had booze on board, and their ships didn't. They had a fair sample of that too, and that they enjoyed that. So we got on fine with them. Fife, as an admiral, he was wonderful. He was very sympathetic towards our cause, and so we got on fine with them.
Let's talk then about the progress of the war. I mean, people hearing of the progress of the landings and what that would then lead to.
Yes, well...
What were you doing? What were you up to? What
did you hear? Well, while the landings were going on in Normandy and the advance across France, we were doing trials in Scotland with our new submarines and so on. And a lot of the time we weren't doing anything, waiting for the next operation. So that seemed to go fairly well. It took a bit longer than we thought getting across France. Of course, we know all about that now from documentaries and so on. But as far as... We always had a good optimism about the war. That there's never any doubt that we were going to win, because you, in your own flotilla, you gauge the general success on your own success. And as long as we were hitting a few targets, we thought it was going all right. So our morale was really quite good. And when we got out the Pacific, it was quite obvious then that the Americans had the upper hand. They were giving the Japanese a pretty good hiding.
What were you hearing about the Pacific region? And
well, the recovery was underway at that time. The Germans were being booted out of the outposts, and in fact, we were only just in time to do anything at all. Our first operation took place on the 31st of July, and on the 14th of August, the war was over. So we only had a fortnight of it. That was quite exciting, because the atomic bombs were news to us. We didn't know anything about those more than we did about the D-Day landings. Only those who had to know knew about that. So that was... as soon as I read on the ship's news board that they'd two atomic bombs, they called them, and I thought, that's going to be atomic. We knew of atomic energy, because it's been under study for years, but we didn't know they'd succeeded in building bombs. So when I saw that, I thought, well, the end of the war can't be far away if they've got weapons of that magnitude.
What were your duties to be, though, in the Pacific region?
Well, when we got sorted out with the Americans, they first of all said they didn't want us because they were going to win this war on their own. Then the captain of the flotilla found out that they wanted submarine telegraph cables cut, and he said his submarines could do it. And so the Americans immediately accepted that because they didn't want to have to do it. It would have been quite an operation for a surface fleet. And we were the only submarines, I think, that had the capacity for putting a diver out. So when we heard about that, the ship went straight off to the Whitsunday Islands, where we did trials, and then across the Hervey Bay off Bundaberg, we did more trials. And we were told we had to find the technique of locating and cutting submarine telegraph cables. And the reason we were told was that obviously they wanted the Japanese to use radio so they could be intercepted, and if we cut their cables, they couldn't use them, they'd have to use radio. But we were told it was in advance of the retaking of Singapore, that we know now it was in advance of dropping the bombs. The President wanted to know whether the Japanese were considering acceptance of surrender terms given to them, and he couldn't wait for the diplomatic channels. He had to find out by eavesdropping. And the best way was to cut these cables between Tokyo and Singapore. That was pretty heavy traffic. So we were given that job and we did it. But the trials for that were quite interesting because we had to, first of all, find out the best way of finding the cables, which is by grapnel. And whereas cable ships are big and powerful and can tow a very heavy grapnel, because they've got plenty of horsepower, We only had 30 horsepower, so we had to do it with skill rather than brute force. So each of the captains designed his own grapnel, and all the others designed up a reef anchor, which is just a four-pronged anchor, prongs being made of sort of 3/8-inch diameter mild steel. And I reckon that wasn't very good, because they always drop with two prongs down. I want something with one prong down so that we could concentrate the mass that we could tow on one digger. What we found from the book of cable workings, there's a grapnel which is a diagonal plate, and ours was about a 3-foot side plate pulled along by one corner with a tine, the part to be dug into the sand, because the cables would be buried in sand, in the shape of a crescent moon. There was a slot cut 4.5 in the plate, and this crescent moon inserted halfway through it, so half stuck down and half pointed up, welded in place, be very strong. And these tines, which is like a plough tine, had to be thin but deep, so they wouldn't drag, but were very strong, so that when they got a cable, they would stop the submarine. That's how we knew we got it. So we designed this and had it made in the ship's workshop, and it worked every time. Very good. The others, with the reef anchor type, they had a lot of bother. And in Hervey Bay, two of the submarines, having no success, put the divers over to swim alongside the grapnel and watch it at work. Well, that was a big mistake, because swimming for a long time is very tiring. And on oxygen, that's good news. And these two divers drowned. So we lost two men in 2 days. But we couldn't wait. we had to get off. It was urgent. So we shoved off for Subic Bay, where one submarine was unloaded to trawl at Hong Kong. And we came back to Brunei Bay, in Borneo, and I was unloaded there in XE4. We went to Saigon to do the job. Well, our job went very well. The chap who went to Hong Kong, he didn't do too well. It was very muddy, and he didn't think he'd cut the cable. All he cut was the diver cut his finger off in the cutter, in the confusion. But after the war, they found the cable from Hong Kong to Saigon wasn't working. But it might have been due to natural causes. Anyway, the communications were certainly cut. We cut both cables at Saigon, and that was it was nice to finish the war under complete success. Two submarines at the same time went to Singapore to attack two cruisers that had already been torpedoed. They were moored in Johor Strait, and the Americans wanted these further damaged in case they had to take Singapore, because these cruisers probably had guns still working, and these guns faced the way the British guns didn't. They faced towards the Johor Peninsula. So two submarines went to Johor Strait, and only one of them succeeded in attacking one cruiser, Takeo. So when we got back from Saigon, these two aircraft got back and decided to send two aircraft again to get the other cruiser, Myoko. So I was chosen to go back on that one. So we just got back from one operation, we were sent on another.